This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a renowned film critic, journalist, author, and podcaster whose movie reviews and commentaries have brought him great respect both within the film industry and among the general public. He's held a number of prestigious positions, including artistic director at the USA Film Festival in Dallas, arts and entertainment editor at The Advocate magazine, film critic for MSNBC.com, senior film critic for The Wrap, and featured critic for Rotten Tomatoes. He co-hosted the TYT Network program, What the Flick, and he's been a writer and editor for The Village Voice, Movie Line, and Detour magazine. Currently, he's the chief U.S. film critic for The Film Verdict. In 2005, our guest wrote a great book entitled 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men. 5 years later, he published another really fun book called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, which highlights the best and worst movies of the Yuletide season. A few years ago, he followed that up with another wonderful book that he co-authored entitled I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. And now he's released his brand new book published by TCM entitled Hollywood Pride, a celebration of LGBTQ plus representation and perseverance in film. This meticulously researched and beautifully written book reveals the fascinating and often suppressed history of the evolution of queer culture on film, spanning from the dawn of cinema through the pansy craze of the 30s, the Red Scare of the 50s, the new queer cinema of the 90s, all the way up to today, chronicling the evolution of LGBTQ plus storytelling. This comprehensive book is entertaining and insightful and highlights the most important groundbreaking movies and showcases the achievements not only of the actors, but also the writers, directors, producers, and others behind the scenes whose achievements defined and exemplified the best of the film industry. Our guest is a member of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association and the National Society of Film Critics, and he currently co-hosts three highly popular podcasts, Linoleum Knife, Maximum Film, and Breakfast All Day. He's also appeared on CNN, PBS, TCM, ABC, in addition to being featured in numerous documentaries. I'm delighted to welcome Alonzo Duralde to our show. Alonzo, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for that intro, Harvey. Do you do eulogies? Because I don't know if it's going to get any better than that.
It's going to get better than that because you're going to go on to do a lot more.
Well, thank you for having me.
Alonzo, first of all, congratulations on this new book. I absolutely loved it. The reason I loved the book is because, in my opinion, you've achieved two important objectives. First of all, you pay tribute to artists on both sides of the camera who've made monumental contributions to cinematic history. And secondly, you've showcased the most important movies that have told queer stories or resonated in a big way with queer audiences. Tell us what inspired you to write the book.
Well, the book was brought to me, actually. The TCM has a publishing arm, I guess, with Running Press, and they have put out a series of really great books, and I'm thrilled that they are, because as somebody who writes books about movies, I know those have been harder and harder to get published in the internet age, so it's great that TCM knows their audience and has an audience for books like this. So I sort of see this as part of an unofficial series they've been doing A few years back, they had the great Donald Bogle write Hollywood Black, which was a history of Black films and artists in the film industry. That was followed a couple of years later by Luis Reyes' wonderful book, Viva Hollywood, about the Hispanic and Latine contributions to cinema. And so now we're getting to the LGBTQ plus history, and I'm just thrilled that they asked me.
Alonso, given the reality that so many gay people, especially in the early days, had to remain deeply closeted, is it ever really possible to create a truly exhaustive and comprehensive list of every gay man or lesbian who made a major contribution to cinema?
I mean, probably not, unfortunately. I always say that this is one of those rare areas of scholarship where, you know, birth certificates and land records are not going to give you what you want to know. If you lived a very quiet, discreet, closeted life, you know, and there aren't people who are still around to tell your story or to remember you, it is very easy to disappear into the mists of history that way. So we're doing our best with what we can and what we have. And certainly the work that I'm doing here is very much, you know, a continuation of what so many great writers before me have been doing. Vito Russo's The Celluloid Closet, William Mann's Behind the Silver Screen, you know, B. Ruby Rich's New Queer Cinema, just to name a few. So if anything, you know, they're passing a baton that I'm trying to, like, you know, move a little bit forward, and then, you know, hopefully the next writer can take it from there.
Well, because of the necessity of being closeted, or as George Cukor put it, circumspect, yes, during the golden age of Hollywood, how much of the historical detail in your book is based on gossip or rumor or speculation versus provable facts?
Well, again, you know, the provable facts, unless you've got Polaroids, sometimes is a little hard to come by. You know, I mentioned in the foreword of the book that gossip does become the sort of basis for a lot of queer history, not just in cinema, but in general. And within that, I think I've really tried to be choosy about who my sources were. You know, Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon is a very entertaining read, but it does not hold up to much scrutiny or fact checking. But other sources like William Mann, I think, are more researched. They did more interviews with, you know, people who were alive during that period, you know, who had direct or indirect knowledge about people's, you know, personal lives and sexualities. And so I think that within that, I have done the best I could to, you know, tell the story as truly and as extensively as possible, while still understanding that some of it is based on secondhand knowledge, because people were by necessity having to cover their tracks during their, you know, their time, you know, when they were working in the industry.
There were so many surprising facts that I learned in the book, Alonso. For example, I wasn't aware that Fatty Arbuckle, Harold Lloyd, and Charlie Chaplin all appeared in drag in silent movies. And I didn't know that before the Nazis came into power, there were a number of very daring and avant-garde gay movies made in Germany. During the course of your research, were you surprised by any of the information you uncovered?
Definitely. I think, you know, having worked in queer media and at queer film festivals, I had a pretty good working knowledge of a lot of the history being covered here, but there were absolutely little corners along the way of discoveries for me. Like I did know about Different from the Others, because while I was working at Outfest, the Outfest UCLA Legacy Project did a restoration of the film, working from a very small amount of extant footage, but also kind of, you know, finding original screenplays and that kind of thing to sort of put intertitles in to explain, well, in this sequence that is now lost forever, this happens and this happens. But there were definitely, you know, people along the way that I did not know about. Angela Morley, the first openly trans person to get an Oscar nomination, two of them, in fact, in the 70s. I didn't really know about James Crabe, who is the cinematographer on films like Rocky and The Karate Kid, but actually came up through this organization, you know, which is maybe putting too fine a point on it, but a loose assemblage of gay men in the industry and drag queens that called themselves the Gay Girls Riding Club, that made these very campy short films that they would screen at bars and at parties, which you can now actually watch online. They've been restored in the past few years. But, you know, there's figures along the way where it's like, yes, we all know about, you know, Cukor and Rock Hudson and Marlena Dietrich, but there were definitely some other people, you know, what we call the below the line categories, you know, in the crafts departments that were new to me.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned some of those people. I want to highlight a few of the iconic people you've paid tribute to in your book, starting with William Haynes. He was a movie star in the 30s who refused to be in the closet, so he quit show business and became a hugely successful interior designer in Hollywood. Everyone knew that he and his partner Jimmy Shields were an openly gay couple. He was a real pioneer, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Not just because he walked away from the industry. And the reasons behind that, you know, depends on who you ask. Like Mann's book, Wisecracker, about Haynes, basically says that, you know, the studio wanted to force him into a sham marriage and he refused. Other accounts from Shields himself, or sorry, from Haynes himself, sort of imply that, like, you know, he was kind of a collegiate leading man and he was getting a little old for those roles and it was sort of time to move on to something else. But as in Hollywood society, when nobody would ever show up at a dinner party or at a major function with their same-sex partner, Haynes and Shields were invited into everybody's house, you know, whether it was, you know, Louis Mayer or you know, a night at the opera, whatever, like they would be seen together. They were understood to be a couple and everybody was fine with that. And so they really, you know, forged a path for other couples that would come along later.
I want to ask you about the legendary director, George Cukor, who was well known within Hollywood circles to be gay. He is widely considered to have been the greatest women's director. Do you think that back in the 40s, when people used terms like woman's director or woman's picture, was there a gay connotation to those expressions?
I think depending on how you were interpreting them, I think there was definitely a level of condescension, you know, that there were sort of like two-fisted action, you know, manly movies that were important. And then there were women's pictures, you know, like you'll hear when people will use the word melodrama, you know, like they're saying soap opera. It's a little bit dismissive, like it's, you know, it's soapy, it's sappy, it's less important. But obviously women's stories are as important as men's stories. And I think when the term women's director was used about Cukor, there was a little bit of a wink involved, like he is good with the ladies, if you know what I mean. And he's somebody who, you know, comes to Hollywood as pictures are starting to talk and, you know, directors who could handle big action sequences realize, oh, somebody's got to actually work with the actors doing the talking part. Like, I don't know how to do that. So we'll bring in what they call dialogue directors. So, you know, you had one director who'd be off, you know, with all the airplanes and the falling boulders and whatever else. And then, you know, Cukor and other people who would come from the theater would actually sit down with the actors and be like, all right, this is the emotion of the scene, that kind of thing. But yeah, I think that Cukor turned that into a strength and was like, okay, yeah, fine. I'm the women's director. Give me all of these movies where there are female leads. And in the 30s and 40s, there were a lot of them.
Now, as you know, Alonso, there's been endless debate over the years about whether certain legendary stars were gay or perhaps bisexual. I'm talking about people like Katharine Hepburn, Greta Garbo, Cary Grant, Marlena Dietrich, Barbara Stanwyck, Tyrone Power, James Dean, Agnes Moorehead, so many others. Do you think the sexual orientation of those people even matters at this point?
I think it matters to the extent that the community has a history and that history is important. I think if it weren't important, so many people wouldn't be trying to erase us from it or erase the queerness of certain individuals. It's very easy to think that, you know, if your political agenda means depicting LGBTQ people as an other, as a them, as a nobody really knows them, we don't care about them, they don't contribute anything to society. So I think it is important in that respect to be like, you know what? This star that you love, this writer you admire, this director who made this movie that means so much to you was a member of the LGBTQ+ community. On an individual level, I don't know that it ultimately matters. And I think that, and I try to address in the book, like some of it, we're just going to have to live with the mystery. You know, I think Dietrich, there's enough of a paper trail there of partners that she had that she was clearly bisexual. I think with Garbo, the same, even Tyrone Power to an extent. I think William Mann definitely found some of the people that he'd been involved with over the years. But yeah, Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, we just have to kind of wonder, and we're always going to wonder because they're long gone. They've taken their lives with them, and what's left is the work. And I think that in a lot of cases, the work is still important to them as a queer icon, whatever their own personal lives were like. The way that Cary Grant plays around with the notion of on-screen masculinity, or even James Dean for that matter, the way that James Dean's character in Rebel Without a Cause is accepting and loving of Sal Mineo's character, who has a picture of Alan Ladd in his locker, and I think is pretty clearly coded as queer, you know, the way that Stanwyck and Hepburn defied norms of femininity, you know, that they were tough and they were take charge, and, you know, Hepburn's insistence on wearing pants, you know. So I think that as at the end of it, you know, we're not always going to know, but I think that it is important to acknowledge the great queer artists, because there are always forces out there who are trying to pretend that we've never contributed anything to society, that we don't matter. And that's clearly not true.
It's certainly not true in Hollywood, that's for sure. You wrote about the motion picture production code, which effectively banned any honest or realistic depictions of homosexuality from Hollywood movies from the 30s to the 60s. And it also stifled queer movie stars in their personal lives, didn't it?
Yeah, because this was another thing that I learned in doing the book. Like, I knew about the code. I knew that it had this very sort of strict enforcement about, you know, against sex perversion, as they put it, which was their sort of umbrella term for anything that might have been queer in film. But studios were also sort of inflicting the dicta of the code onto the personal lives of the stars, you know, that you need to get married, you need to marry a man or a woman, you know, depending on what the case was. And you know, it there was a conservatism that really crept into the industry, partially from the code, partially because, you know, the studios were starting to acquire exhibition chains and getting money from Wall Street. And so, you know, there was a lot more eyes were placed upon them. And so, yeah, unfortunately, it did force a lot of people further into the closet, or to sort of live out these kind of sham relationships in some cases that were just there to sort of fend off the gossip columnist. You know, Tab Hunter famously talks about how he and Tony Perkins would take whatever starlet the studio had set them up with out, you know, to a premiere or, you know, to be at the dinner at a restaurant to be photographed. And then they would drop the girls off at home and go home together. You know,
those morality clauses in their contracts were really powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so people, it kept people in line in a lot of ways, unfortunately, that did sort of force them to make these choices in their lives.
Alonso, there were some movies you included in your book that really surprised me, and I'd like to mention some of them and get you to explain the gay undertones in each one, starting with The Maltese Falcon. What was gay about that?
It's funny. I just watched that again this weekend. The Maltese Falcon, there's a couple things. Mainly is Peter Lorre's performance as Joel Cairo. When he is introduced to the film, before he even enters, Effie hands Sam Spade a calling card and he smells it. And there's this like flourish on the soundtrack. And she says, "Gardenia." And in comes Joel Cairo with his, like, you know, with the permed hair, the pinky ring. He's got this cane that he's fiddling around with, and it's got the 90 degree handle that he's pointing at his mouth, and it's like, okay, you know. And again, I think this is what the code did to film, was they tried to erase queer people, but it just made everybody have to be a little bit more clever, a little bit more subtle. There was an earlier adaptation of The Maltese Falcon in the 30s with I think Warren William, where they were much more overt about, you know, characters' sexuality, but here they had to just sort of imply and, you know, sort of weave it in between the lines. You've got the Elisha Cook character, you know, whom they call a gunsel, who, and I think that word, you know, became, people thought, oh, so he's like a gun-toting henchman, right? But actually that comes from a Yiddish word meaning little goose, which Hammett used because his original term that his editor wouldn't allow was catamite, which is basically the idea that this character, that Wilmer, is the sort of sexual plaything of the fat man. So there's a lot of queerness in that movie. You just, again, as with so many of the movies during the code era, you have to kind of look at it the right way to find it.
This is one of the reasons I love your book so much, because you make us see these movies differently. How about Red River? What was gay about that movie?
There's that legendary scene in Red River. Well, actually, there's a couple of things there too. But the one that everybody points to is the scene where Montgomery Clift and John Ireland admire each other's guns, swap guns, and then sort of show off their shooting prowess to each other, which is capped off by John Ireland saying, "The only thing better than a gun is a nice Swiss watch or a woman from anywhere. Have you ever had a nice Swiss watch?" And then there's also the whole fact of, like, the filmmaker, Mark, Rappaport has a film called The Silver Screen, Color Me Lavender, where he sort of explores queer tropes in Hollywood movies. And he coins what he calls the Walter Brennan syndrome, which is the character, usually in a Western, who's the sidekick of the hero, whose entire life is built around the hero. He's just there to help out, to yes and. He talks about the life they'll have together when they get a ranch or whatever. And it's like, it's not overtly queer, but there's something happening there. And Walter Brennan is Walter Brennaning hard for John Wayne in Red River.
Brilliant. The next movie I want to mention is Casablanca. Why did you include that movie in your book?
This is the thing I wrote originally back in 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men, and I stand by it. The real love story in that movie is not Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. It's Claude Rains and Humphrey Bogart. Claude Rains is so in love with Rick for the entire film. He's just always like, ooh. I mean, he just can't get enough of everything that Rick says or does. At one point he says, Rick is the kind of man that if I were a woman, I should be hopelessly in love with Rick. And then how does the movie end? With Bogart and Bacall, or sorry, with Bogart and Bergman together? No, with Bogart and Claude Rains walking off together in the mist, and Bogart saying it's the beginning of a beautiful friendship. I'm sorry, this movie is queer-coded out the yin-yang, and I'm going to die on this hill.
I am getting my eyes open like you can't imagine. What about Showgirls? What was gay about that movie?
Showgirls, there's a lot happening in Showgirls. I mean, first of all, it is a film that I think loans itself to a camp reading. You know, that it is a film that is taking itself seriously, but is sort of absurd at the same time. And how much it's knowingly absurd or not knowingly absurd, I think, is a matter of taste and debate. But there's also, again, the key relationship in that movie is the one between, you know, Nomi Malone, played by Elizabeth Berkley, and Crystal Connors, played by Gina Gershon. The way the two of them circle each other, they, you know, they each have sex with Kyle MacLachlan, but it's really the two of them and the way that they're sort of facing off and challenging each other and trying to take each other down. Like, that's the central relationship of the movie. Like, they should just go ahead and kiss already. So yeah, Showgirls is the gift that keeps on giving for audiences, because I think it's an easy movie to goof on and think is ridiculous. It's also a movie that the more you look at it and the more it sort of loans itself to actually being taken seriously as a genuine sort of dark satire about show business and what it does to women. You know, it's a movie about Hollywood, but they set it in Las Vegas to make it all the much more sort of tacky and tawdry. But I think the points that it's making about, you know, celebrity and fame and the entertainment industry are as applicable to cinema as they are to, you know, the big ballroom show at the big show at the casino.
Well, finally, I want to mention the 1999 version of The Mummy. Were there gay undertones in that movie?
That was a surprise to me as well. So while I was writing the book, I was like, I knew about, you know, movies like Showgirls that were sort of, you know, gay cult films and lesbian cult films. I didn't really have any bisexual cult films, by which I mean films that aren't specifically explicitly dealing with sexuality, but that nonetheless have an audience among, you know, that segment of the community. So I just put the question out on social media. I'm like, hey, bisexuals, what's a bisexual cult film? What's a film that you know, the bisexual audience embraces and loves, even though there's nothing in it that is specifically, you know, pointedly bisexual at all? And overwhelmingly, the response I got was, oh, 1999's The Mummy. And I didn't get ever like a formative answer here. Like, I mean, I'm sure a lot of it is just like, you look at Brendan Fraser, you look at Rachel Weisz, and you're like, yes, all of this, please. But, you know, I'm taking it from the people I asked. They came forward and they were all about, oh, yeah, we love The Mummy. So whether or not the makers of The Mummy know it, they have made a bisexual cult film.
Who knew? Now, you wrote about four male heartthrobs in the 50s who turned out to be gay. Rock Hudson, Tab Hunter, Anthony Perkins, and Sal Mineo. They lived very difficult and stressful lives in the public eye, having to hide their homosexuality. But the Hollywood media at that time knew the truth about these men, and they kept their secrets, didn't they?
Yeah, there's a whole there's a whole other book to be written, frankly, about the entertainment media and what it does and doesn't go after. You know, in the same article of Confidential Magazine, where they tried to peg Elizabeth Scott as a lesbian, which by most accounts, she wasn't. There's also an article in there about Tab Hunter getting, you know, arrested at a, you know, like an all-male pajama party or whatever sort of goofy terminology that Confidential Magazine would use. And then it came out years later that apparently Henry Wilson, who was the agent of both Tab Hunter and Rock Hudson, gave Confidential the Tab story so they wouldn't run a much more damning story about Rock Hudson. You know, and Confidential was sort of an outlier and they eventually kind of got sued out of business. But yeah, for the most part, if people played the game, you know, most of the columnists would sort of go along with it, you know, unless you got Hedda Hopper angry about something else, she was just going to kind of ride with it. You know, I know that Raymond Burr, for example, had a great relationship with Hopper because her son happened to be a cast member on Perry Mason, you know. But yeah, it was a moment where I think a lot of the entertainment press was sort of like, you know, Pravda for the Kremlin. You know, they sort of understood what the party line is and what we're going to say and what we're not going to say. And it's really not until a later period that you see, you know, kind of the scandal sheets really going after people and trying to expose things. Whereas I think before there was a bit of a detente between the studios and the really powerful columnists as far as like, you know, what they were going to talk about and what they weren't.
Yeah, there's really been a shift from the media protecting certain celebrities to the scandal sheets. You wrote about the actor Tommy Kirk, who was outed, and that had the effect of ending his career. I want to tell you that when we had the iconic actor Gordon Thompson on our show, mm-hmm. he expressed outrage that he was outed by a journalist. How did you feel about outing?
Well, actually, Tommy Kirk wasn't outed by a journalist. Basically, somebody's mom told Walt Disney about it, and it was all done internally. And Disney fired him just from you know, when he called Tommy Kirk in. Tommy Kirk said, "Yes, I'm a gay man," and that was it. As far as outing goes, I mean, I think it should be saved for people who have actual power to make queer people's lives worse. You know, I think if you are a Republican senator who votes against civil rights measures and who votes against, you know, AIDS funding or whatever else, and it turns out you also are living this secret life, then yes, absolutely. You do not have a right to privacy in this point. You are actively betraying your own kind. As somebody who was around in the 80s, I understand the frustration with closeted celebrities at that time when the AIDS pandemic was raging, when it was a literal life or death matter for people. And it became, and you know, the preeminent notion was that AIDS was a those people thing, and that those people weren't anyone you knew or cared about. Vito Russo, who wrote The Celluloid Closet, said in an interview one time, he picked up a copy of Life magazine and it said, you know, AIDS, now it affects the rest of us or all of us or something. He goes, as though I weren't the person holding the magazine, you know? And so I get why activists of that period were like, you know what? Your silence is not helping. And in fact, is actively harming the community. And so we're not going to be party to that silence anymore. As for now, I don't think it happens. I think that we've reached a point now where most actors or musicians or whatever kind of take it upon themselves. You know, you do occasionally get somebody like Rebel Wilson, who was like, all right, this journalist is trying to out me. I'm just going to do it myself. So yeah, I think it is the kind of thing where you have to sort of let the celebrity in question make the choice for themselves. But again, if it's somebody who has genuine power over, you know, how people's lives are, and they're using that power, you know, in a detrimental way, then, you know, they get what they deserve.
Oh, absolutely. A number of celebrities, including Jodie Foster, Ricky Martin, Lily Tomlin, Anderson Cooper, they were relentlessly pressured by the gay community and the media to come out until they finally did. And I don't think any of their careers suffered by coming out, do you?
Of those specific ones, I don't think so, no. I mean, I think with Lily Tomlin, like, you know, she and Jane Wagner had been partners for so long that it was just kind of understood. And Jodie Foster is a fascinating case because I think, you know, I remember even at my most sort of fervently like, oh, I wish, you know, celebrities need to come out. I always thought Jodie Foster got a lifetime pass because of the Reagan shooting, you know, that her, you know, the assailant, you know, saying that he was doing it for her to liberate her from Hollywood or whatever. I was like, all right, that gives you carte blanche to never talk to the press again. That gives you carte blanche to like be as private as you want to be as uninvolved with, you know, the ins and outs of your own personal life. Like you, that's a, you're golden. You just go and do whatever it is you want to do. And then she did finally decide to come out, you know, at the Golden Globes. And I admire her for doing so. But yeah, I don't think it's affected her career at all. I think, you know, she's clearly, you know, I think where it gets tricky is, you know, I think it's about, you know, leading men and women who are considered sort of, you know, sex symbols. Because if you're a leading man and women love your movies because they want to imagine themselves being with you, I'm not saying that coming out is going to ruin that, but I think the thought is that coming out is going to ruin that, or that the coming out means you're only going to get to play certain kinds of roles, which I think we can point to lots of examples of, you know, Neil Patrick Harris on How I Met Your Mother, for instance. Like, you can absolutely play aggressive heterosexuals and still be an out gay actor. Like, that's what acting is.
Well, you quoted Rupert Everett as saying that coming out for gay actors is still extremely risky and that he would not advise any actor to do it. Did that surprise you?
He's been saying that kind of thing for decades now, so it didn't surprise me. And I get where he's coming from. I mean, I think a lot of times you will hear from actors who came out, you know, earlier than maybe it was the society was ready for it. And it did have an impact on their career. Certainly, like in the new queer cinema, people like Craig Chester, after starring in Swoon, or Guinevere Turner as the, you know, star and co-writer of Go Fish, you know, have sort of semi-sardonically made references to like coming out when coming out wasn't cool, and how they couldn't go back and do it again. It was already, you know, they'd already done it. And so, you know, I think part of the whole history that's been covered in this book is how receptive are audiences, how receptive is the media to this information, to this level of honesty. And, you know, people coming out now, the young people who can come out as, you know, queer or non-binary or whatever it is, are going to have maybe not the same kind of hurdles that somebody like Rupert Everett did coming out in the, you know, late 80s or whenever it was that happened. So, as the world changes, so do the circumstances around coming out.
Well, it's so interesting to contrast what Rupert Everett had to say with what Ian McKellen said. He said that prior to coming out, his acting was fake, and that since he came out, his acting is about revelation and truth. And so he recommends to all gay and lesbian actors that they should definitely come out. Isn't that refreshing?
Yeah, no, he's... Yeah, God bless her, Ian. He's the greatest. And it's absolutely true. I think that what an actor, what the job of an actor is, so pretty much often involves, like, you know, your own lived truth. And I know from my own experience when I was in the closet, like, there were just always sort of things that were walled off and things I had to think about all the time about, don't mention this or don't respond to this in a certain way or whatever. And you know, actors have to be just sort of open to everything and be able to sort of channel everything, you know, that they take in and that they put out. And so I mean, I'm not an actor, but I totally get what Sirian is saying, that it opened him up as a vessel, as a performer. And yeah, I would hope that people are taking his advice.
Oh, I hope so. And I hope that the public is accepting of the fact, as you said, that they're actors. You know, there were some major developments in the late 60s that affected our community. The production code ended in 1968. The American Psychiatric Association stopped labeling homosexuality as a mental illness. And the Stonewall riots happened. How long would you say it took for those changes to be reflected in a meaningful and positive way in Hollywood movies?
See, meaningful and positive, I would say, are two different things, because there was absolutely you could sense that filmmakers were embracing the notion that they could include queer characters in movies once the code went away. But very often, because these movies were being made by straight white cis men of the late 1960s, these characters were not great. They were villainous or they were pathetic or whatever, and they were just sort of there to sort of throw some color in. But, you know, I think that I think the late 80s is really where you start seeing a queer indie film groundswell happening. I mean, in 86, you've got Parting Glances and Desert Hearts and My Beautiful Laundrette and Doña Erlinda and Her Son all opening in like the same 2-week period in New York City. And it's really starting to bubble up. And those are films, you know, often made by queer people, whether filmmakers or writers or whatever, and are more honest and genuine reflections of what LGBTQ life is. But, you know, even before then, like I think in 1982, you see there's kind of a mini boomlet of Hollywood movies coming on the heels of the controversy of Cruising, coming on the heels of the Anita Bryant, you know, battles in Florida, where you get films like Making Love and Personal Best and Victor Victoria that are trying to expand the notion of what it is that films are doing. I don't think anything... it happens overnight. It is all sort of it's a slow, gradual thing. And that's why in the book, I try to, you know, it's divided into decades. And I try to sort of give you the behind the scenes of things like the American Psychiatric Institution, of the context in society of against which these movies are happening. And I think often films are kind of late in really reflecting what's going on in the world, just in the way that they're produced and also in the sort of general reticence among producers to get too far ahead of what they think the audience is ready for. So, you know, these big changes happen in society, and then slowly but surely we get there on the big screen too.
We finally get there. There's a very famous and notorious male rape scene in the 1972 movie Deliverance. Yeah. You said in your book that that scene triggered widespread panic in the gay community. Why?
It triggered gay panic among straight men. I think because, again, it's a great movie, and I've got nothing against it, but I think that for a lot of straight male viewers, it was the idea of being sexually assaulted by another man was something they'd never seen in a movie before, maybe had never considered before, and so it definitely, like, you know, It definitely set off, you know, what we call gay panic, the idea of like, oh no, either something terrible like that's going to happen to me, but even to a lesser extent, just the idea of someone might think that I'm gay because I'm affectionate with my friend, or I'm wearing this color shirt or whatever it is. And you know, I think for generations, I think straight guys were really terrified about that, but it's not something that's always been around. I mean, you go back to Wings, the very first Best Picture winner in 1927, and, you know, the war hero, you know, daring World War I flyboys in that movie hug each other, they kiss each other, they cry on each other's shoulders. There's a level of affection there that straight men felt comfortable expressing that subsequent generations of straight men would be terrified of, because, again, you know, once homosexuality starts surfacing in American society and being talked about and being visible and being existent, it was like, ah, no, I'm not that, you know. And I think finally, generations later, we're getting to a place where we have parents who are telling their, you know, their sons, it's okay to hug your friend. It is okay to play with dolls. It doesn't mean anything about your life. And if it does mean that about your life, that's good too.
Yeah, I'm into that. I tell you, because I remember back in those days where gay men panicked because we didn't want straight men to think that we were interested in seducing or raping them. So I really think Deliverance set us back a little bit. And I want to tell you, in preparation for our interview, I conducted a little experiment. Uh-huh. I asked a number of straight friends to tell me which movie comes to mind when they think of gay movies. And the overwhelming response was La Cage aux Folles. And although I did enjoy the movie, in a way it bothered me that straight people were so entertained by the extreme lengths that a gay couple had to go to in order to accommodate an intolerant straight couple. Did that bother you at all about the movie?
Yeah, that's a movie that has always, you know, there have been things about it that bug me. That's part of it. And I think that the thing is that queer people are called upon to do that kind of emotional labor all the time, whether it's don't talk to grandma about your boyfriend, or, you know, I've got these people coming to dinner. Could we seat you with this other person? That kind of stuff, it's constantly being thrown our way. And I think the movie isn't presenting that as like, this is a terrible thing that gay people are stuck with doing. The movie presents is like, oh, it's just wacky farcical setup. And of course you have to do that because, you know, why wouldn't you? Plus the fact that you have this central character is this couple that's been together forever, however long, and they demonstrate no affection toward each other. Like, there's not one smooch or hand holding or any moment where they're not sort of sniping at each other. But, you know, that movie was a huge, huge hit in the 70s. And there's that template of like, what are straight audiences ready for? And for a while, you know, La Cage aux Folles was about as far as we were gonna get with that. But to go back real quick to the thing about Deliverance, you know, a thing that I see online all the time that I really like that women have said is that straight male homophobia is very often rooted in the idea that another man will treat them the way that they treat women.
So telling. So telling. You wrote about the importance of the movie Philadelphia in generating empathy for gay people and AIDS victims among mainstream straight audiences. But did it trouble you at all that the gay couple in the film were portrayed by two actors who were well known to be straight, Tom Hanks and Antonio Banderas, and they showed almost no physical affection towards each other? Did that bother you?
You know, at the time, I think probably. I think Banderas got a pass because he made all those amazing Almodovar movies and had, you know, thrown himself into playing really interesting and complex queer characters for him. But I have to say, looking back on it, I think it was all very shrewdly put together. You know, you could make that movie, you could make Philadelphia and only attract like audiences who were predetermined to want to see a movie about AIDS. Or you could make that movie and put, you know, America's boy sweetheart Tom Hanks in it, and you could give audiences, you know, the Denzel Washington character and put him on an arc of not liking gay people and then coming to understand that gay people are human beings. And you could not have the two gay characters kiss and thus have no one run out of the theater screaming. And you get a lot more people to see that movie. And that's maybe craven, but I think in this case, for me, and you know, everyone's mileage will vary, I think the ends justify the means. I think a lot of people saw an audience that maybe made them more compassionate about people with AIDS, that made them more understanding of gay people and more tolerant and more willing to, you know, open their minds a bit on the subject than would have if you'd made that movie for the people who were already on board for all of those things.
You know, when you explain it that way, Alonzo, that makes a lot of sense to me. It was a strategy to maximize the empathy factor. And I really appreciate that. You definitely removed some of my resentment. Now, after the success of Brokeback Mountain, I'm sure you remember the predictions made in Hollywood that there would be a flood of big budget LGBTQ films, but that never happened. Why not?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was at the Advocate at that period, and we were all like, okay, yeah, here we go. It's coming. And you'd get a few announcements of a thing, you know, like the Dreyfus Affair, some other films that were being talked about. And yeah, it didn't. And I think what it comes down to is, and I've seen this happen time and again, when a film about anything that isn't straight white cis men becomes popular. So like the Sex and the City movie or Black Panther, you know, like any films that don't center, you know, the kinds of people that are usually the lead characters of a Hollywood movie. If movies like that break through and find a crossover audience, not just big in their own demographic, but with everybody, they are almost inevitably written off as a fluke. It's never looked at as like, oh wow, there's a hunger for more stories like this. It's always, well, yeah, that one worked, but I mean, where, you know, that's lightning in a bottle, we can't get that twice. Whereas any other kind of movie, You know, if a Fast and the Furious movie breaks through, then suddenly you've got four more movies about, you know, cars and, you know, jumping off things or whatever. But yeah, I think the fluke factor is really hard to overcome, where, you know, instead of looking at a breakthrough like that and thinking, ah, here's an untapped audience that we've been ignoring for too long, and they've turned out in droves because they clearly want to see this kind of material. Instead, it's like, well, yeah, that happened, but, you know, we're not going to bank on it happening again.
And maybe they're right. Maybe you can't reproduce that magic. I don't know. But the last movie I want to ask you about is Moonlight, which yes. was a small, low-budget, art house film about a Black queer character. How surprised were you, Alonso, when the movie won the Academy Award for Best Picture?
Very, because I still bear the scars of, you know, Oscar night 2006 and being sure that Brokeback Mountain was going to win Best Picture and then having it not go that way. So for a movie like Moonlight, which is, yeah, low budget, queer, Black, no big stars in it, you know, aesthetically challenging, you know, made by a filmmaker who cites, you know, Claire Denis and Wong Kar-wai as his inspirations. I was completely flabbergasted, especially, and of course, the famous moment in which it didn't and then did win Best Picture, which was, you know, a lot of Zapruder rewinding on our DVR that night. But yeah, that was thrilling. And again, did that open the floodgates for more movies like Moonlight? No, but I'm glad that Moonlight exists, and I'm glad that it received those kinds of honors and continues to be appreciated as a modern classic.
Well, when you look at the success of Moonlight, I mean, it won the highest honor the Academy can give. Mm. What do you think the impact of that success has been for LGBTQ filmmakers and for our community?
Good question. I mean, it might be too soon to tell. You know, I think sometimes these things are generational. I think that you know, there have been a lot of opportunities for queer filmmakers to get their work to an audience in the last few years, but that, you know, comes out of a lot of different factors. You know, streaming, I think, plays a big role here. It no longer becomes a thing where, like, oh, I have to find, you know, a distributor who's going to take my movie and put it in theaters, or we're going to do an opening and see if people show up. You know, now it's like, all right, we're putting it out there. It's going out into the world. And I think that, you know, it opens up the gates a bit in terms of, you know, what kind of financial returns you have to have, and the sort of the physical outlay of, like, creating posters and prints and that sort of thing. But, you know, I would like to think that if you are pitching a movie like Moonlight, you can point to Moonlight as an example of, hey, look, this movie made money, this movie won awards. Like, there is, you know, I'm not coming to you from Mars with this. Like, this is part of a tradition of films that have proven themselves to be the kind of thing that people want.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's ultimately going to be a very positive development. And the fact that there are so many streaming platforms, and then there's so many shows like ours where you can try to promote a movie and yeah. reach an audience, hopefully will make it easier for filmmakers from our community. Well, Alonso, it's been a real pleasure meeting you and having this chance to showcase your wonderful book, which is Thank a you. Really important contribution to the literature of cinema, because it's such a comprehensive compendium of LGBTQ culture in the movies. Thank you for writing the book, and thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been a lovely conversation, and I thank you so much for your kind words. I really appreciate it.
Our guest has been film critic and author Alonso Duralde, whose new book, Hollywood Pride, A Celebration of LGBTQ+ Representation and Perseverance in Film, is now available on Amazon, on the TCM website, and wherever books are sold. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.